both of those use cases in what I just described, and it's maybe bad that we're doing that because it's not clear line, but I'll just describe how we're doing it in my view. The way that we're doing it is, the first one is that we've got disputes that were generated by the dialogue as opposed to disputes about the dialogue, within the dialogue itself. Like, I think it's red, you think it's green, we're disputing about that, and that is what the dialogue's about. I think we should give $3 million to this and $2 million to that, and you're reversed, and we're dialoguing about that. So the first one we're doing, is it spam, not spam? Is it abuse, not abuse? Have you violated a rule that constrains the dialogue? There's one in there that's weird, which is this duplicative or not? But apparently, the Napa one has a rule that you can't have duplicative postings. In my mind, that goes over the line into substance, and you're not talking about substantively. What are you talking about? Is it the same or not? Is it? That's the same qualitative question. Is this a better idea or not? Or is it, should it be severed into two ideas or not? You know, that's a substantive question about the idea. In my mind, it sort of blurs. And I think we theoretically could ask either type of question or both types. And I think it is useful to separate dispute resolution for like a Wikipedia dispute over was George Washington's teeth, you know, wooden or not, or some dispute about the substance versus a dispute about abuse of the system. I think there are different kinds of disputes.
Are we going to go into this? Is this because
I think where maybe this hits dispute is in terms of public dialogue is we're at uncharted point again with this ability for instead of in the past sending messages in to government and in some cases they're read and kept secret or kept private and then sometimes they're uniformly made public. That's sort of the what has been the case. Now we're getting into a situation where government's saying, let's have this dialogue in public, and the problem is there for dialogue to work, you need to filter out noise. And so the question is, if we have something where the public gets to participate, there question of whether or not they can participate fully in the way they think they want to is being mitigated or hurt by others who might say that it should be, you know, put as over a spam or something like this. These are real disputes, I think.
Censorship.
Because they go counter to what has previously happened in terms of how these things get dealt with. So I think that as really, we're making new ground to even consider that a dispute. I don't think it necessarily was if it was purely dialogue, but now we're getting to legal ramifications, etc. And how does government sort of both stand back, but also allow the folks as part of this to self-govern their own discussion? And I think these have huge relevancies, and I think we're actually creating disputes that have importance into what becomes public dialogue.
Could I just to pick up either way saying I think that you're really talking about norms within networks and I keep the network and how to set those norms and how to enforce those norms. And that's different than resolving something of a factual dispute to the medical record. And I do think that in different kind of networks you're going to have different norms, and that's part of what defines the character of that network. So once that becomes explicit, and you may have different ways of resolving dispute in different networks by around different kind of expectations. And I think one of the things is that's implicit, and people don't know what the rules and what the norms are. And then I think there is here, from a research point of view, what are the best kinds of rule sets and norms in order to advance certain kinds of participation. I think people need to be heard. I think that's a real key element. And spam may just be a social signal of being heard, and that's what they're seeking attention. It's not even the content of it. So how do you deal with that versus something else? But I think you have to sort of go that other level and understand sort of the norm formation factor.
I think that's exactly right. There are antecedents to these big dialogues.
Yes.
That were small dialogues. And these small dialogues, generally in the dispute resolution field, were the category of public policy disputes. Cape Wind, should you stick windmills off the coast of Nantucket? Those are public policy disputes, and there are people who are experts at reaching consensus or trying to reach consensus in those kinds of disputes. Mm-hmm. But the network is clear there. And when the network becomes less clear, and Cape Wind may be an example of where the network was less clear, then the norms are not clear, and the processes become confused. Right. And the we rely in those public policy disputes, we rely a lot on the expertise of the third parties. We don't have that at all here.
Right. Oh, yeah, if I may, just very quickly. So just, again, to contextualize at least where this little test is that we're doing, which is, I think, eventually down the road may be extrapolatable to resolution of disagreeable or disputed questions in public policy one day, theoretically. But right now, it's where I would see this fitting in the ecology of a Cape Wind dispute if that happened in 2010, and they were using these tools, is they'd probably have a bunch of bubble-up dialogue tools for general participation and ideas. They'd have a bunch of participatory collaborative tools to respond to architects or different plans that may be on the table that the development authorities and other people had, and that would be a different set of dialogue tools and rounds. There'd be some other set, and then there'd be maybe another thing to start winnowing down or doing, you know, prioritization selection for the last few plans, and maybe eventually it would be some sort of straw vote on the final thing if they wanted people's opinions. And along the way, there'd be disputes in that process about, like, was my thing filtered out correctly, or was this meeting valid or not, because I don't think it was held in the right way according to what the public sunshine laws say, so therefore that shouldn't be part of this anymore. There may be disputes procedurally, or very tight, definite disputes, and the reason, and I think that this might, we're tooling this to fit with that, because we'd like to make sure that what we're doing here isn't just another Facebook app that crowdsources out into the nowhere and you don't know what it's worth, but that we are actually applying higher common denominator due process and fairness standards that would be appropriate for public processes one day. Notice, opportunity to be heard, you know, the basic stuff we'll go over today. So that's, and that also really narrows the set, lets overkill for most of the kinds of disputes. It's not the right kind of dispute resolution for public policy dialogues and debates, I wouldn't say. So I'd say that we'd fit in that sub-segment here, but the lessons we learn one day could be used for referenda.
I think the point that you're making, this turns out to be a mosaic. It's not one answer, and your point is right on. How do you start with definition of a dispute, but it gets quickly to what you're saying. If you raise this up and you say you start off with a dialogue, then the dialogue gets into a debate. A debate gets into an argument. An argument gets into a real dispute. The dispute goes all the way from, let's try to resolve it between ourselves, let's go to a mediator, an arbitrator, litigation, and so forth. The hierarchy coming down is consistent with the suggestion that you just had in terms of the model. Depending upon where you are, if it's just a dialogue, then you want to facilitate a constructive, participative kind of dialogue. You want to set some rules out so that people are behaving amongst themselves and everybody can be heard, as we're doing right now. As it moves away from being a dialogue to a debate, then what you've got is different rules about how people debate in terms of what can be presented, not be presented, who has what time, and so forth going on. And then as you start moving along that spectrum, as you point out, different behaviors begin to manifest itself, existing protocols take over, and also getting back to the network situation, a network of medical professionals who are debating a medical procedure is a lot different than a bunch of copyright editors sitting in a room debating upon how you're going to apply copyright law to a particular piece. Functionally, it looks very, very much the same, but the content, the consequences, and the behavior of the individuals is very different.
Quite.
So your point about networks flows in. Are we talking about a dialogue? Are we talking about a debate? Is right. And then your point about the behavior of the people is also manifested there.
So. We'll need to, after just a couple more comments, we'll need to move forward so that we can ground this in a video by David Colarusso that will describe a little bit more about one of our tools. I'm sorry to cut you off, and Diane, I think you had something.
So I think when, sorry, I forget your name.
Mike.
I think one of the things that you said, you brought up the idea of content, and the content of the dialogue or the debate, and the factualness and the validity of that content. So what I'm most interested in, and because what we are trying to create is standards, XML standards around that content, so that when you cite something and when you link to it, how do you judge what is the spam, right? So if the content in the spam has valid citations, is valid factually, and if it even goes to the health records, and you know, how do you validate that content so that it's not spam, so that it's contributing to the dialogue, and how do you, if possible, judge or automate the validation of that content, and anything we can build into the systems to do that would be most interesting to see.
And forever toward, you guys should definitely talk. Mm-hmm. For sure, with Just Systems, and you have a lot to talk about. I'm sorry, Jonathan.
Well, I think the question of legitimacy comes up in here, and I think, and you have different standards of legitimacy in different contexts, but I think it does come down to how to establish a fact base in a context, mm-hmm. and how to do that in an independent, right. transparent way that then has legitimacy. And so one of the things that the words of the or point of view is sort of, how do you look at the building blocks of these things? And some things may be amplified and have different aspects and parameters than others, but there are certain key components that you have to have. And I would think that would be absolutely essential. I'll leave it with that. We can go on and on.
On that, I guess, as a segue to what we're about to see with David, I think those are, in fact, the salient questions, and what we're postulating for purposes of evaluating what this test would be is we're postulating the following scheme, okay? You know the dispute, many of you know, and some of you may not know, that there's a online dispute resolution process already that works pretty well under a similar scheme for domain names versus trademarks. And the scheme by which that works is there's a big nonprofit called ICANN that has certain policies and that has certain authorities to, by private law mostly, and contract, to say what the terms and conditions are for domain names. And one of the terms and conditions are you submit to arbitration according to our online processes. If there's a trademark holder that says that they have your domain name under certain policies, everyone signed a contract up front. There's a nonprofit that's kind of setting the general rules. In this case, it would be the eCitizen Foundation and postulate, at least, although you guys would be the puppeteers telling us what we're doing. And everyone would have signed a contract, and then we would just abide by those rules. So that's the legitimacy in the business model here. But the reason we're making a tight sandbox is to see what would it take to make that sandbox into an infrastructure.
If I could just add one more thing before,
please.
Kind of as a segue to the interview. I think kind of bringing together all of that, one of our driving research questions is whether it's possible to have one platform that can address all these different types of disputes. Public dialogue, dispute about facts on Wikipedia, an eBay transaction dispute, the ICANN domain resolution policy.
Right.
Is it possible to have an idea of dispute that allows it to be put onto one single platform?
I'd say, quickly, absolutely not.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's an easy one.
It's a mosaic of a bunch of things.
Are we ready for the video?
Let me just ground something about
10:29.
Sure. That what we have in the form of public comment for regulations are hundreds of thousands of people sending messages in. There are clear laws governing how that happens. And we have gotten to the point where federal agencies don't know how to deal with it because they get this stuff in and they are literally using tools. And Stuart Shulman has been working on some of these tools to allow everybody to, quote, consider all of them. There are laws. We're getting into an area where I don't believe there are laws for public dialogue for the purposes of influencing it. When the Federal Register puts out something, they put it out for comment. What we're doing is uncharted waters, I think, in terms of how people get their ideas and public comment into government. I think if we're coming up with this, we're going to, I think, have to realize that legal layer isn't yet done. And what we do has the implications on what may then become the legal layer that government then decides to use to apply to the process of people self-identifying how they want to comment.
Right.
Yes. I just raised a separate procedural issue. Carolyn, Beth and her assistant are going to call in around 11. Is there a phone here it's going to ring? Or?
Yeah, you've
got
it set up in
the
Zoom.
Great.
They may call in a little earlier.
God,
that gives us some time to see David's video and have some discussion and open discussions should they come in. Great. So without further ado, this is the indomitable David Colarusso, who is a law student now at North Eastern, and who I first met when he was primarily doing a little startup called Community Counts, where he developed one big civic engagement application, open source one called, we co-branded it Big Dialogue, but it's the Community Counts engine. We teamed between him and MIT's Media Lab, where I was at the time, to do Ask President-elect Obama a question, a big bubble-up thing. And we actually generated a lot of disputes, and it ended up being him and sometimes me, like, figuring out, is this spam or not, and trying to put things in the right categories. And we realized, wow, we need to fix this, and it has to be transparent, and should probably be a lot of eyeballs, not just us, and should probably be fair. So that's partly what led to some of these dialogues. And he's an ingenious programmer and a keen legal mind as well in training. And he's volunteering at this point in order to be part of this collaboration to code these modules for us and to assist us with the testing through the summer. And then when he goes back to school, he's off duty. So that's basically it. So this is David giving us a talk through of what he can do and some of the questions he has for us. Slowly.
Is this over the internet or can you...
I have it on my computer if necessary.
Yeah, if you could pull that up.
Yeah. What's it called? Do you know the name?
Moderation engine. Then it's a MOV file.
You know what? You have it, I think.
Yeah, I do.
Daniel has it. It didn't get all the way downloaded. So maybe...
I can't lip read that slowly.
Training, Liberty training program.
Yeah.
While that's coming up, can we continue chatting along?
Sure. Yeah.
One thing I wanted, it seemed to me, I was just listening to your comments a minute ago, you really described the spectrum of human interaction, mm-hmm. right? And so going to Urs's comment about, you know, what we're trying to do is create a use case, which is basically something to work on, something that is doable, right? But in trying to all the while anticipate what the future is holding for us, what's our end point here? What's the goal? Your point really drove home to me that what we're trying to do is map the panoply of human behavior. Now, that's been done. If we turned off all our computers and you kind of look around, that's what a culture is,
exactly.
Right? That's how we interact. That's our body. That's the organs that we've created for ourselves. The institutions we have, the dispute mechanisms. We know when the red light is there that we're supposed to stop because you don't crash into other people. It's a rule set that makes us function together. It's an interoperability, human interoperability rule set. And when your question before about what's a dispute, it gets really interesting in that context when you talk about all possible interactions. Dispute really, it seems like it becomes an information interoperability situation, right? That you need, right? You're trying to figure out, you have this information, I have this information, is there a problem, is there a mismatch? When you have a good functioning organism, right, the things kind of get worked out, and if you don't have it, you have disease, right? I mean, there's correlations you can have in biosystems and say, what's a functioning system, what's a non-functioning system? It gets really challenging to consider, my God, do we have to map the entirety of the human experience now? And the answer is no, because that's already been done. And then I started thinking about, well, does online, in our context here for today, modify dispute, or does online modify resolution? It modifies resolution, I think, in your question, right? Because we're trying to figure out, oh, we got these new tools. Well, isn't that fantastic? Let's help use these to help.
Hey, all. Sorry, I can't make it to the audio.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. But it was interesting because it all kind of came together, and I was thinking, gee, we're really at the cusp now of a paradigm shift, and the reason for the struggle is we're trying to push everything into this program, and obviously we want to anticipate what's coming in the future, but we can't possibly anticipate all of it. Right? The challenge is just too great.
Right. I mean, that sounds like one of the questions Ursa was asking, which is, would this online crowdsourced dispute resolution be appropriate also for offline disputes? And that's an excellent question. And it's in theory. Right?
It's kind of similar to what's going on in the telecommunications clients that I have are all talking about augmented reality versus immersive experiences, right? So you have Second Life, mm-hmm. which is very immersive, and that's supposed to take, that's your entire experience, versus augmented reality, which is the notion of take your disputes that arise in physical space and resolve them using electronic tools.
Yeah.
And there's both pieces are going on. We have the immersive element of all, when you're dealing in electronic space and resolving disputes in electronic space, but also we have the electronic tools to resolve things that happen in physical space. And there's obviously the distinctions are being lost there.
Exactly. Yeah. Good. So I think this is about a 9 minute, almost 10 minute video, and it should set up the context pretty well. And we had a debriefing, three of us with David Colarusso last night to nail down some of the specific things that he'll need for us, and we can do a walkthrough of that after you've had a chance to see what he's up to. So I think this is the perfect place.
Hey all, sorry I can't make it to the ODR meeting. Early this week at PDF, Joey suggested I send along a video documenting where the development stands. So here it is. There are three main parts to this video. This introduction, a cutesy little overview, and some final thoughts. The overview is a draft of something I'd like to include on the tool site once we launch the beta. It uses some screen captures from the actual alpha version, and you'll see that not every bit of functionality is there yet, but I think the main structure and ideas come across. The overview gives a description of what the tool does in a very general way, with a little animation. Then it walks you through a hypothetical use case, touching both upon the human interface and the API. Screen captures are from the actual alpha up right now at moderationengine.org. Any of you can go there, create an account, play around. However, please remember this is an incomplete alpha build. It's buggy, things are going to break as I tweak the site. It's not ready for prime time, so please don't be passing the URL around. That being said, enjoy.
Here we are at moderationengine.org, and the first thing we're going to do is create an account. At the top of the page, you'll notice a navigation bar. Here you'll find a link entitled Create Account. After clicking on this, just fill in your email, click Sign Me Up, and wait for your invite email. Within a few minutes, you should receive an email with your login information. Follow the link provided and log in. By default, you land on your queue. Once you've joined a group, this is where you'll find content to evaluate. You may have noticed that after logging in, the navigation bar has changed. If you'd like, you may change your password under the settings link. This is also where you may input demographic data. The moderation engine is primarily a research tool, and we'd really appreciate the data. Completing this section is optional. However, some groups may require that you complete specific fields in order to evaluate their content. A side note for the ODR people, right now this section is really small. As we move forward, we need to ask what data we really want to track, and once we know this, we can collect it here. Now, let's go ahead and create our own group. You'll notice a link entitled Groups. Clicking on this link brings you to your Groups page. To create a group, we simply click Create. We're presented with a set of fields to fill out, including the group's name, description, and so on. You'll notice that right now the evaluation criteria only supports plain text. This is not what the beta will look like. The plan is to provide a set of prompts, allowing authors to create a decision tree, making use of yes and no questions, as well as numerical and text inputs. Imagine a prompt which generates branches every time you provide a choice. For now, I've just filled in the field with some simple text. Likewise, the triggering criteria asked for on the second page, too, will involve more elaborate input. What you're looking at right now is in process. All groups require a public contact email, which we verify. This helps prospective users vet the groups they join, even if all they do is check the email's domain. So before we can do anything with this group, we must check our inbox again, looking for an email verification. Note, this does not have to be the same email you used to create your account. To verify the email address, simply click on the verification link provided. Now we can see our group under My Groups. Since we created it, we also note that it has a gold star. This means we can add content and edit some aspects of the group. In order to maintain the integrity of evaluations, however, you are only able to edit a few of the group's features. Clicking on a group makes this obvious. If we want to add some content for evaluation by the group's members, all we have to do is paste the content's URL and hit Add Content to Group. Now let's log in as a user who already has something waiting in the queue. Once we log in, we'll be directed straight to the queue, where we can start evaluating content. To do this, we simply click on the content and give it a look. We can evaluate the content by clicking on View Criteria and Evaluate. We can also skip a piece of content. Now, there are many more nuances to the site, but hopefully you've gotten a good overview. Once we finalize features and behavior, we'll go ahead and make these features available to developers through an API. A working draft of the API documentation can be found by clicking on the API link at the bottom of most pages.
All right, so hopefully that was helpful. Also, going to the website is probably a nice thing to play around, and I'll be getting the code up on a code repository sometime soon, and then we'll also start instituting bug tracking. So I'll be in the loop with everyone who wants to be in on that by email. So just shoot me an email and let me know if you want to be that involved. As we move forward, next month, 2 months, my goal is to go ahead and take that alpha and turn it into something that we can release as a public beta. To do that, I'll need a couple things. The one that this group is going to be able to help me the most with is in defining a set of criteria, a set of data points that we want to track about users, the things that we're going to be interested in mining for the research. So we need to get those down so that they can be built into the system. And then additionally, this group can help me in coordinating with potential individuals and groups that might help provide use cases. So when I was at PDF earlier this week, I talked to some people, David Stern over at Mixed Inc, and Jim Gillum over at White House 2 and Nation Builder, and talked to them about maybe integrating or using the public beta and using some of their data and maybe just running it parallel to their existing systems. Jim seems a little busy. I don't think he's going to be able to do much with us, but David seemed interested, and he's been working with Mixed Inc. They've been working on the Office of Information, the President's little thing there on IdeaScale, though one of the last versions over is on Mixed Inc. So he's probably a good guy to be working with. That being said, if anyone knows anyone over at IdeaScale, that'd be great if you could put me in contact. The idea is I want to make sure that I'm getting input at this point from any potential users. That way we end up giving them a tool that they're likely to use and that they'll enjoy using. If you have any questions, go ahead and just shoot me an email. And I'm sorry I couldn't meet you guys, but when you watch this, depending on when you watch this, it'll probably be my first week at my new internship. So I couldn't just show up and say, hey, I'm here, but now I have to go away for the afternoon or something like that. So I hope this is helpful. And again, if any questions, just shoot me an email. And I look forward to meeting you all someday. All right, cheers.
Thank you, David.
Okay. So is Moderation Engine, it seems to me, it's basically a way to, you get a group of people and you give them a problem and you have some sort of, you basically say, like, if more than 70% of people say this is obscene, then it is obscene?
And that's basically what it
then
is.
That's exactly right, yeah. Okay. Part of the question we have here in theory is, under most sets of circumstances, you know, that would be not sufficient. You know, so the question would be, what is the delta between what you just said and what additional safeguards, protections, functionality, features, requirements, prohibitions, yada, yada, would be necessary so that that would be an acceptable outcome, that when X percentage say it's spam or it's abuse, that would in fact be an acceptable outcome, or at least sufficient to clear up on the hierarchy, to the gentleman's point, on the hierarchy of disputes, at least be enough to clear a whole mezzanine of underbrush of disputes that could easily be resolved that way, and then identify the smaller number of disputes that would have to be escalate to maybe, you know, arbitrators, mediators, the judicial system at some point. What would it take to get there?
I think what helps is a little bit of the context of what the moderation engine is in terms of what we're doing. And specifically, as a testbed engine, there will be the possibility of working with NAPA or others to test out whatever we come up in the theoretical world in it. And so, whereas this is not the place to do the actual discussion, what this is something that we can just, for, again, testing, whether it's the Plone or the idea scale or the whatever, that when a dispute happens on that other place in the context of a dialogue, they can shoot over for the purpose of dispute to the moderation engine. So there'll be dispute about a particular argument. That will have a URL. There will be a web page that will be forked over to here. People will have been added in to test it, whether it's the control group or the public or however we set that up, and then this allows that decision tree to process it and then hand back whatever the decision is to whatever platform the public discussion is happening. So that's why it's called it the moderation engine. It's really for the purposes of this testing, a way to outsource it so we don't have to ask any of the people who have the public discussion to build quickly a way to do the test bed for it.
So that goes to my question before about this online modified dispute or resolution. Here it's an online resolution tool, right, that can be used for online disputes or offline disputes.
Right.
Yeah. So now that you've seen what David Colarusso has said, let me put that in a little bit of context, and maybe Ethan can help us reflect on what's happened and helps lead through sort of a reflection on what URSS and what we've said so far a little bit, leading up to Beth's call. So here's the, we're going to have a walkthrough of a project plan at the end where we could make sure that we've actually got, you know, a detailed level of logistics and everything handled, but this is at more of a conceptual level, how it is things are going to go forward. The first thing that David needs, okay, so the way that we'd like to kind of, the chicken and the egg kind of resolve that, is David first of all showed us that idea, that's the reflection of some things that we said, so that's a start. Now the next step would be for us to give him some data that would be, we can talk about the syntax for that data, but some data that would in fact be the questions that the mediators or the moderators would be answering. So for example, and the format for, and so an example in a jury, at the end of the litigation, the judge may tell the jury, you will, you know, first say, like, is the defendant guilty, you know, liable? If the answer to that is yes, then to how much money? And if the answer to that is yes, then blah, blah, blah. And if the answer to that is no. So they'll give instructions. So we'd have to give them, in essence, a set of instructions of what is it that we're asking you to determine, okay? And the format in which we'll give them those instructions is a question tree. That's what was finally settled upon as an appropriate starting point. It's definitely not the only way to give rule-based instructions and processes for decision-making and dispute resolution by a wide stretch, but this one is a good start, and we know that we can achieve it quickly enough to do the test through the course of the summer, and it would go something like this. The generic one would be, is this blue, yes or no? You know, if yes, then is this a bread box, yes or no? You know, if yes, then is it a, you know, whatever? And so we would ask those kinds of structured questions to get yes, no answers, and based on that, compile data from the mediators and then tabulate, you know, like you showed on the scales, you know, according to a set point that we would determine in advance, whether or, you know, whether or not the, it's been a yes or a no. You know, basically, whether the dispute has been resolved in favor of the disputant or the appellant or whatever, however you want to call it. So one of the things we'll get to soon is what would those questions be, and what we'd like to do is have a process where we talk about the questions that in a way that and where we give David a draft, an initial draft of those questions about a week from today. We've had a chance to talk about them today, iterate some things back and forth, and give them questions. And then those are, I'll just quickly say what the next three steps would be, and then let's talk about all of this. After we've given them those questions, which would be like spam, not spam, abuse, not abuse kinds of questions for this use case, then he will give us about a week after that the draft API, which would be, and we'll have to talk about that, but we're talking about possibly XML or RDF, and there's some other conversations about the language it could conceivably be expressed in for his Perl-based system that he's using. But he'll give us an API, and we'll have to work with him on the language and exactly the syntax and everything in that API that would allow us to actually effectuate this system. And we'll give, about a week after that, we'll give him feedback on the API and give him an opportunity to actually code the alpha, the final alpha version of what we just saw today, according to the questions that we told him and the use cases that we tell him. And we hope that by August 1st, August 3rd, August 5th, somewhere in there, that we will have, that he will then give us back a 0.1 like alpha set that we can open up to some hundreds of people to begin testing on. We plan to get disputes from hopefully Beth Novak and possibly Linda, possibly PK Agarwal of the state of California and other people that are doing public sector bubble up civic dialogues that have generated disputes about whether this is legitimate or not a legitimate posting. Some people say you're censoring me, other people say this is abuse. So that we already have those sets of things that we can use and that people have agreed to give them to us in theory. We need to actually get those. But once we have those, we would, in the month of August, literally use that system and have people go through these questions about those dispute sets. And then at the end of August, we would, Daniel Bennett and I and others in the Citizen Foundation would basically compile all those results and show them back to this August group, the coordinating committee and others, to evaluate them and to consider what they mean, to do some conclusions and feedback that would hopefully let us take whatever the code was that did whatever it did and let David tweak it so that it was more like a beta code that we could show at the end of the summer potentially.
Why don't you just use the dialogue that's going on that just was finished? Dialogue.
Absolutely. So what we'd like to suggest procedurally, and we'll get into that more detail when the project plan is, that we actually do initially what I would call a batch approach. So as opposed to trying to hook our exploratory engine up to a real-time dialogue generating disputes and having it, you know, parsed out in real time, to me that seems like too many moving pieces for what we're doing now. So instead we want people to send us, in essence, like a batch of 500 disputes, or maybe from Linda it's a batch of 20 disputes or fewer. And then in that batch we would then basically allocate them out to people. So that's exactly what we'd like to do, is take actual disputes so that we're not inventing them, but from something that's done, and then see how they look in our sandbox.
Well, this is done.
Yeah, exactly. It's perfect.
There's a lot of statistical techniques for interjudgment reliability. And I don't know if you're looking at that.
I don't know what you mean.
A whole lot of content analysis stuff where you have people judging something, and then you're able to establish the validity and reliability of the judges, and then you can develop a statistical measure for that. So you talk about legitimacy, those are well-established techniques. So
that would be some information that I would like to put that as a bullet item for a conversation that we have on the phone, that we could then see how do we reflect that in the data we're gathering for evaluation at the end of the summer.
So you could just play, you could judge each judger on those terms, and then actually come up with a measure of how reliable and how valid they are.
I'm not sure I follow. In a reputation system?
It's used to judging. I mean, I can show you offline. This is well-established in content analysis, having judged it, some qualitative judgments of something.
Okay.
To see to what extent they are valid with respect to a set of criteria, and then what extent to they reliably apply the criteria.
But let me give you an example that's concrete. NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, has for many years conducted large-scale evaluations of systems, for example, search systems. And one question is, are the search systems performing well or poorly? Are they getting back the documents that the query should be responding to the query? And that requires an evaluation of material that's been returned by a query in a search system. So NIST has employed teams of people to sort through all the documents that have come back in response to a query. That sounds like a factual matter. Is that document on topic with respect to this query? But of course, it's a human problem. Mm-hmm. It's a cognitive problem. And so there's a great deal of disagreement, not disputes, just genuine, sincere disagreements. And that's a fact of almost any kind of group-based decision. So you get this inter-rater reliability phenomenon. If you find a inter-rater reliability, two judges agreeing at the rate of 70% on a set of tests, that would count as very good inter-rater reliability. It's remarkable how low it can be in ordinary contexts. You might see inter-rater reliabilities of 40%.
And that would that be good enough in some cases, 40?
No, generally not. But systems can be designed that exploit even very low levels, what might be called common, sincere misunderstandings or disagreements respecting interpretations of language or terms, the human phenomenon. You can design systems so that even with such low inter-rater reliabilities, you can generally have a better performance in the aggregate. But that requires a statistical design in the way in which information is presented.
Good.
One way you would do that, for example, is present some items, let's say items 1 through 10, to one judge, but present them in the order of 10 to 1 to another judge.
Yep.
Then you control for factors like recency and prominence, some other psychological factors associated with when people first experience or adjust their understanding of what the topic or problem is. And so by mixing and redundantly presenting the information, you can begin to develop a statistical model that gives you a pretty good sense of the likelihood that the group decision is going to be correct. Mm-hmm. And that's a probabilistic model. So it's never a question of yes or no. It's rather whether or not you could rely on the judgment of the group to a certain degree.
And the name of this is called? Not correlated, what was it called?
There are a number of
inter-rater reliability is the term.
Integrated
inter-rater.
Inter-rater reliability.
Invalidity.
Reliability. Invalidity, too. There's another validity measure.
Thank you.
I think so then we'll the question that we should collect that we need to get to David in the context of evaluation is, and we talked to him, anything that happens needs to be able to be audited afterwards. And so the question is, how do we capture the transactions in ways that we can analyze it later? And so I just want to make sure that we'll try our best to capture everything and then turn over the data so that not just us, but anybody else can take a look at it and see, did the theoretical models match up with the results? And so the question is, we have to make sure that we're capturing everything possible for that. Yeah. And if we can get feedback on what needs to be captured, not just what we need to push to David for what the decision tree is and how the theoretical models get applied, but also what we need back from any results.
Right. So in other words, Jen, just back to just crisp that up a little bit, I have taken from this part of the dialogue an action item. The action item that I've taken so far, and we'll check all this at the project plan at the end, would be, it says inter-rater reliability important, talk to both you guys after the meeting, basically, and to discuss how can we address this meaningfully in our alpha tests, how could it be perhaps addressed differently, more robustly in beta and subsequent tests after that, but how do we address this now? Is there some data or something that we can be reflecting in the system that we're doing over the summer?
You're capturing the data. Yeah. It's just a question of applying the measures.
Like, for example, would we want to potentially tell David as a requirement to for each judge randomly reorder it and then capture some data? Or
you might. In fact, I think rather than worry about the design up front, because you've really got your hands full with a lot of other issues that are much more operational, just build in a little bit of reasonableness in the design, capture the data, and post hoc evaluate the data. Go back and determine whether or not you, in fact, were getting reliable results.
And part of what, so part of the, what our dialogues would be for this phase, then I would have structured dialogues with you in interview format, you know, if you'll fear it, where I'd say, what types of data are you sure you want to capture? I'll make sure, I would run the traps with David on the server logs to make sure that when you see a report of the test, you have a column in a human readable way that gives you that data, not 10,000 pages of server logs and good luck finding it.
Sure.
Okay, so one other thing that maybe we can talk about quickly is what would the questions, oh, I'm sorry, Diane.
I think that's actually where I'm going is I always go back to the content. And so I know these are bubble up dialogues. And what I was seeing on the screen was a link to, you know, a YouTube video or a URL right. or something Different. Like that. But what is the actual content that they're looking at to that is spam
yep.
that they're getting to evaluate, and how are we mining that if it's a chunk of HTML for the concepts that are in there that are is this a bread box, is this blue, you know, how do we
right.
get those
that's,
concepts?
That's exactly that what I'd point. Like to take us to. Thank you.
Okay.
So. And then from there, I think a lot of us can really get into the dialogue in a great way, because then we'll have something we can look at where we can look at it from the point of view of XML, for example, and AI and the law and some of the other disciplines that we have experience in. So this is what we have so far. Do you mind if I just write it on the board? Would that be okay? The first question that we would ask would be in our draft set. And please, I haven't even mentioned this to David yet. We just brainstormed it last night so we'd have something to start with. Not is it blue or a bread box, that's not really good. I think the first question, now this is inside the manifest, okay? This is not all the outside stuff about allocating to the right number in the right order or anything outside like that. This is now I'm sitting down, I'm a mediator or a judge or whatever, and I'm going to start adjudicating. What happens from that point forward, okay? In the jury box, in a sense, with the instructions, that's where we're looking. So I think the first question off the top of my head would be, you know, is it in violation of any applicable rule?
So what is he looking at when he says that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
This.
So, excuse me. View
of the posting.
So they'd have like the posting that is they would view the post. Number one. And then the questions would be, and that would be the same as like, I saw the witness say I didn't do it. I saw the prosecutor say he did. I saw the eyewitness. So they saw the post. Now, here's the question. Is it in violation of applicable rule? And we'll make sure that they know what the applicable rules are. And they're a little different for depending on what the use cases are. The federal ones have spam. It has like abuse, libel, duplicative. It has like seven specific things, which are somewhat unique to the way they did that one. Those would, in fact, be the ones that we would apply, I think, unless we change them. So basically, the first question is, is it in violation of any of these rules? And we'll tell you what the rules were, okay?
So they view the post and view the rules.
First,
is the first thing.
Even before they view the post, in order to be a mediator, they'd have to know what the rules were and be pre-qualified and sign a contract and do some other preliminary things, but they would know the rules. And then the question we'd ask them to evaluate as a human being with gray matter as opposed to silicon is this in violation in your subjective judgment of any of those rules? If no, that's pretty short. You know, we'll go to a final question. If yes, then I think the next question, if it's yes, is, you know, which ones? And then, you know, for each one, if it's like, well, I say it was duplicative and it was abuse, whatever, like let's say there's two, you know, then if it was duplicative, you know, put the URL to the post to which it was duplicative. So now we can assess that. Other people in escalation can, if need be. If it was abuse, like, put the quote of what you think where the abuse was, or characterize what it, you think it was. You know what I mean? So like that would be what they would say. And then I think the next thing would be, gosh, I don't have it open. We had another question. Oh yeah, if it wasn't something that Scott suggested, we might. And I think that's pretty much the kernel of it right there. But Scott had an interesting idea, which was if they say no, it's not. If it's no, I'm sorry, this would be I guess 1A. This would be 1B. Not three. If it's no, then we might ask them in text for their opinion, not that it's going to create a different result necessarily, but even though it's not in violation of any rule that we told you applies, do you nonetheless think this is so serious that it should be censored for some other reason? If yes, say why here. So if we don't yet have rules, but there's like, wow, 80% concurrence that this is a problem, we can maybe escalate that to an executive committee, and well, maybe we need now an eighth rule, you know?
So that's the situation where it doesn't violate a rule, but I think it should.
Yeah, I think it should. And then we just ask them why state the rule.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
that would be like, okay, here's 100 characters, state the rule. The rule is you should not steal from another person, and this is, in effect, stealing bandwidth, or whatever the rule is they're stating.
And what you're doing there, in a sense, is moving to that next project, which is to start to develop legislation, right?
Right.
You start to develop rules saying, whoa, this set of rules is inadequate. We have a bunch of people who are experts saying it's inadequate. What's adequate?
You get a whole new
feedback
negotiation. You have a ninth rule, as you were saying. There's eight. Now you get another discussion going on as to the merits of a ninth rule.
And all these rules are for,
yeah,
all these rules are for one identity. There's not different participants or I don't know if it'd be networks or privileges based on your role in discussion.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
So this is every posting has the same rule set applied to it. There's not different privileges
for
different
users.
Oh yes, that's
right. In this case, luckily, I mean, in more complicated dialogue, there certainly are different roles and people have different ability to say different things. Like congressmen can say almost whatever they want, you know. But in this case, luckily, we've selected that out. So this dialogue all occurred under the same set of terms and conditions. And that's good. Now, one question we have, though, that I would have is, I don't necessarily feel we have to repeat the mistakes of the past. Like, if they didn't get the right rules, I would like to ask Beth Novak, or maybe have you ask Beth Novak, whether she would find it more interesting for us to kind of slavishly apply the rules they happened to have last month, or whether she has a updated set of rules that she would like applied for purposes of our tests. You know what I'm saying? Because in some sense, it doesn't really matter whether these violated a rule from 2 months ago. I think the real question is, how do we get these to reflect rules that the government would actually use in the future? You know, maybe there's only 3 rules or 5 rules or 7 rules, but 3 of them are different. Well, let's start getting experience with those rules, I think, perhaps. So I just want to throw out there the possibility that we don't have to copy and paste the rules from 2 months ago. Maybe we can ask our partners what the rules are they would like us to have reflected. If they have no opinion, we'd use the ones they had. Just throw that out.
They may have had rules. They might not have had rules.
They did. Yeah, there was on the website. They had 7
because,
rules.
Because, I mean, they were relying. They set up this very nice site where you can see all the postings that people rated as bad, irrelevant, spam, or whatever. They collected them and they're public. And I think that's how most of these posts got to that site. They were rated by users. And the standards, I'm not sure were all, you know, as clear as you're laying out here.
Well, interestingly, the standards were clear, and what we heard from, you may remember Dan Munns from NAPA, was that he doesn't think people were applying the standards when they were clicking the spam button. In fact, what I found with David Colarusso when we did one of these for Ask President-elect Obama a question, is that most people that were hitting the spam and the abuse buttons were political people that didn't like the substance of it. So they're like, oh, that's abuse, because I disagree. Well, I don't know. That's not good enough for a final resolution. It's probably good enough just to identify what could be spam initially and to maybe go to crowdsourced alternative dispute resolution, but it's certainly not the end of the answer. And right now, unfortunately, it's the best we're doing.
So I'm sorry, I don't know what all the 7 rules were on that site, but is one of them is a misstatement of fact? So if
can you pull it up? Can you get the
I have open
site?
Government.
They weren't
you
great
turn
rules,
me on.
Excuse me
so
for saying
so.
Plugged in.
I am, but
one of the things that, like, you can automate spam filtering. Believe me, I've worked with companies that write those things, and you're probably using some of it right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, you can spam filter for Viagra.
I know.
Okay, so you can mine for the posting for specific content that we all agree is, you know, most of us agree. That is that should be filtered out and considered spam, so we can get rid of a good chunk of the crap. But then there's then there's this stuff that is someone knowingly misstates a fact, like $22 million were spent on rural housing in the state of Arkansas, and it wasn't. It was $10 million, right?
Right.
It's just where does that misstatement happen, and does misstatement make it spam? That sort of stuff. So I like that there are 7 clear rules. I think that's great. But I think there's also a whole series of other questions that arise that maybe 1B and 1C is like you're looking at this thing. It's not just the posting, but it's the concepts and how they were stated in the posting that makes it spammable.
Right.
That's an interesting point. That's maybe in your bailiwick. That gets very close to free speech.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that's a real issue when you get into this.
Yep.
Well, and you know, if you think about it, in our already we have systems, and it.
I'm sorry.
It, Supreme Court, we go. We're gonna have a call in a second. Supreme Court makes decisions, and they come down 5-4, sometimes 6-3, and they come down. The public doesn't like them. Congress doesn't like them. And this dispute resolution is sometimes doesn't occur. Right? Yeah, right. It's just in the eye of the beholder. But the mechanisms that what it sounds like you're alluding to is that there'll be a mechanistic element which won't, let's say, will involve rule sets or systems that are put in place by people, but people don't monitor and use as kind of easy.
Search for the cache.
Then there'll
version.
Be the elevation of things, you know, 80% taking care of the mechanistic layer. Then you got the 20% that requires X type of process. Then the 20% of that requires a Y type of process, right?
We're in 1103.
The applications of discretion in those contexts and judgment in those contexts is something that can be assisted by the systems to bring people's discretion and judgment to bear more readily, like somebody in remote parts of the world or something like that, which we couldn't do before. But it doesn't ultimately answer the question of the unanswerable questions, right? Like the Supreme Court can't answer what's obscenity directly in every context. Well, this system won't either. You know what I mean? There's some things that just aren't doable.
Do we have any concerns about, and maybe this is too low level, I don't know. But I'm thinking of issues of a representative sample. For instance, if you ask, you mentioned obscenity, right? That's probably the best example of this is we have it in our law where obscenity means different things, different communities. And it seems to me that a lot of these things depend on how representative your sample is and how you're defining that representativeness. And, you know, you can go look at, we had this problem with the Ask Obama a Question project, where it turns out that they did the bubble up thing and the top three questions were all about legalizing marijuana, which, not to disparage the efforts of 420 advocates everywhere, it seems to me like that was an issue that was probably of a unrepresentative sample of internet users. The sort of people who voted some kid from 4chan to the most influential person in the world in the Time magazine poll. So I guess...
I think that we have to be very careful here because if it deals with public discussion, we don't want to get into the how to help public discussions work in terms of getting the best ideas per se. I think what we're going to concentrate on is what the government can sort of do, which is... There's freedom of speech, there's right to petition grievances.
Mm-hmm.
We can't get in the way of that. And so, for example, when Beth Novak and others were talking about it, some of the things that were off message to what they were trying to do, that they don't want to get rid of it. But I think what we're talking about is helping them, and the whole point is to get rid of the noise. And sometimes getting rid of the noise isn't deleting it, but putting it onto the side. And so,
noise, you mean something like a question about marijuana?
No, I'm talking about.
I guess I'm confused.
Yeah, I would say the example that I'm giving, where they have $22 million in their mm-hmm. posting, and it's actually 10, and so you're responding back to the person, you know, it's justifying why they're not being made public is that there's a mistake in their statement.
No, we're really talking about things that hit these rules, which are libel or. Not factual problems, but things where its appearance. In terms of dealing with Congress, and I'm more familiar with that, if someone came on to a public discussion and said, I'm going to vote for you or whatever, and it looks more like a campaign thing, they couldn't have that on the site. They couldn't. So the moderation becomes a thing of taking away or moving aside speech that's inappropriate. I don't think we can or will be asked to dispute what arguments should be brought up, whether they're factual, whether they're not factual. That's really, I mean, one of the biggest campaigns for Congress was to kill the bill that would tax email. There never was such a bill. We're not going to stop people from writing that wherever they want to write it, but there and they.
And the it is there's hoax emails out there saying stop Congress from taxing email.
Right.
So that those are hoax emails, and if they were put in one of these open government systems under pretty much any rule set, they would be filtered out as not valid.
But when people actually read those hoax emails, and decide that that's the voice that they want to bring to a discussion, we can't filter that out.
There's different signal-to-noise ratios, as you're saying, at different levels. If you go into a trial and you're an attorney and you start talking trash about something, you're going to be, it's going to be objections because it's irrelevant. That's not applied in the context of public discourse out on the street talking about issues. That's exactly what you're saying before.
Yeah, but there's a real problem. If that dialogue is going on, for example, about the email taxing bill, and it's on that site, and there's people that start dialoguing on it, and it goes on for weeks and weeks, guess what? The perception is there is a piece of legislation for email.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you can't just ignore it because it's on that site. It's not on somebody's blog site. It's on that site.
Yeah, I'd like to make a suggestion just at this point because I think you raised an excellent point, Diane, about factual and about disputes over factualness. And I included, what I did is I made a general listing of some of the things that I just remember seeing in the terms and conditions for these sites before and the general ones that you see up there, and I included what you said about false assertions, but my sense is at the end of the day, we'll probably want to scope that out for at least the summer project and maybe beyond as not something that we're asking these dispute resolution people to determine just based on their knowledge of the policy before them, you know? I think that we'll have to, I'd like to start with some things that where the people we give it to, if they're intelligent and trained, you know, or informed, they speak language, they're awake, they're whatever, haven't been hit in the head, that they could just take what we told them and look at the posting and come up with a reasonable determination that we can level set against the rest of the crowd, you know. Whether it's factual or not would require now like an additional tribunal of some kind.
The Civicom
consultations, I think. So I'd like to do that. I'd like to take that particular one I'm reluctant to get into. But the other ones I think we can meaningfully deal with more quickly.
So, and Daniel, your point was one of the decision trees you had up there. I'm sorry, I don't know what his name was up there. That's part of the whole governance issue. The real answer to that is to have the community self-govern, and it would really be somebody within the community that pops up and says, it's not $22 million, it's $15 million. And let the community, this gets back to your point about being more of a network, let the community do that kind of policing, if you will.
And that's not disputes. And I think
that's exactly
these aren't disputes. Those are conversations. Disputes are when someone might be censored or pushed aside, breaking
rules. But then is it exclusion?
I think we've got, we may have a mini meeting now for, well, that's on the line, and then we'll pick up where, with after.
I think we've got somebody.
Great. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the meeting. And we'll do a quick round of introductions, starting with Ethan and Urs.
Who do we have?
Who's on the line?
Anybody on the phone?
Yep, we're both on the phone.
All right.
So this is Beth. This is Beth Novak.
And this is Robin Sturm. And I'm actually having a little bit of a hard time hearing. If you might be able to move the speaker closer to the phone, that would be wonderful.
We're gonna hear that.
Sure.
Are these mics. Yes.
Great.
All right, we have Beth for a couple of minutes, and we have Robin for a little longer. Beth agreed to do this without telling me she was on vacation and likely to be at the airport, so we're greatly appreciative.
There's the part about being at the airport you can hear in the background. I'm going to mute my phone, okay?
Thanks.
So I think if anybody has particular questions for Beth, we should do it right away. And somebody want to summarize what we've been talking about, or?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Hi, Beth. This is Daza Greenwood from the eCitizen Foundation, and
actually, it would be helpful to know who's there. Are there a lot of people there? A few people we don't know who we're talking to at all. So
yeah,
not a waste of time to have the interest.
Great. I'm going to pass it to Urs Glasser, Executive Director of the Berkman Center, who's hosting the meeting.